Through the grace of God and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I've been sober since May 30th, 1982, and that doesn't make me a miracle, it makes AA a miracle. And if you're new here today, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I always call it God's magnificent AA, the program that saved my life, and it's going to save yours too, if you're willing to take a few quick actions. And I suggest staunchly to sponsor that you get that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and you get busy and do everybody else is doing around here, and you're going to stay sober as I've stayed sober for 18 years, and people like me cannot stay sober, I can guarantee you. My home group is the Pacific Group in West LA, a group I'm very, very proud to be a member of, just as I'm sure you're proud to be a member of yours. And I guess if you're not proud, you ought to get a job, and you might change your mind. I certainly have a job of mine, and I'm proud to have that job. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. This is an honor and a privilege. It's one that I do not take lightly, I'll guarantee you. You guys, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, I really do, and I think that it shows, and I make an awful lot of mistakes, and I do an awful lot of things wrong, but I'll tell you one thing, that I love you, make no mistake about that. I want to thank Donna for being such a gracious and lovely hostess for me, and so forth, and the committee's just been great. This has been a great roundup, you guys. We owe them a tremendous round of applause, we really do. The speakers have just been fabulous, I've enjoyed all of them, and so forth, but you know, I've been taught to do an awful lot of things before I ever opened my big mouth. And one thing is to talk to my sponsor, and Clancy sends you his love and very best wishes this morning. And I talked to him about an hour ago, and I said, what do you want me to talk about this morning? And he said, oh, quit trying to be cute. Get up there and share your experience, your strength, and your hope, and tell those people what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Ignore the old-timers. They got it. They don't need your inspiration, my dear. And talk directly to those new people with the life and blood of AA. And I believe it as I stand here, and I welcome you, and I hope that you stay. And then I think I did, without a doubt, the most important thing I can ever do, and that's to say, God, please help me say what you want me to say to these people. God is very much a part of my life today, you guys. It did not used to be that way with me, I can guarantee it. You know, if anybody in this room is wondering why I have a man for a sponsor and why I have Clancy for a sponsor, it's really quite simple. I did not get sober in California. I got sober in a place called Lincoln, Nebraska, and I was not doing well in Lincoln, Nebraska in AA. I went through 19 sponsors at a rapid clip, and I'm certainly not proud of this as I stand here this morning. And thank God for the old-timers in AA, because they love me enough to get my current sponsor. And I got to tell you that my life has done nothing but totally, completely turn around as a result of that. And I absolutely adore the ground that that man walks in and so forth. But anyway, I'm delighted to be here, you guys. This is my first time ever speaking in Georgia. I've spoken in every state at least probably 8 or 9 times, but never in Georgia. And I hope it's not my last time, you know. Your hospitality has been very warm, and I appreciate it very much and so forth. But I love your accents. I wish I had one, but I don't have one at all. You know, you guys, this has been the best year of my sobriety. My 18th year has literally just been fabulous for me, and I'm going to tell you why and stuff. But, you know, it just takes one thing to upset the apple cart for me. And about 3 weeks ago, I had, on a Friday afternoon in L.A., I had a terrible pain in my jaw, and I thought, what is up with my jaw? And by, you know, if you were trying to find a dentist in Los Angeles at 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon, good luck, you know. But I found him. I found him at 11:30 at night at a party with his wife and stuff, and he was gracious enough to come out and pull my abscess tooth that I had. If you haven't had an abscess tooth, you don't ever want one, trust me. But anyway, you know, he told me I had this partial plate, and it has 4 teeth in it on the bottom. I know this all sounds real dumb, but I want to tell you what happened. And he said, you can't wear that plate until I get that other tooth added onto it. And he said, and don't wear your old one either because it'll rub your gums raw. And I said, I have to walk around with no teeth? I have to go to Houston, Texas and give a talk this weekend. And he said, oh, well, he could have cared less, you know. And I tried to present this dilemma to my sponsor. Perhaps somebody else should go for me. And he said, have a nice ride to Houston. That's what my sponsor told me. But anyway, the dentist told me, he said, now come and pick up your new plate. They added tooth on it next Wednesday. So I was in that office lickety-split Wednesday, and he said, well, here's your new plate. And you guys, they put the tooth on the wrong side of the plate. I couldn't believe it. And I had to be in Nassau that weekend, and I thought, I can't have any teeth again. I couldn't believe it. You know, I never think of myself as a vain person, but apparently I'm very vain, you know. Well, who wouldn't be, you know? But anyway, and he said, we'll get it done, there'll be no charge. And I thought, well, I certainly hope not, you know. But anyway, I went back in the following Wednesday, and they have lost my plate, you guys. They have lost my teeth, you know. So I have my old plate in here, and one of the teeth is missing. And I thought, oh, I just hate this so bad, I can't begin to tell you. But anyway, it's kind of loose in my mouth, so that's why I sound kind of funny and stuff. But you're just going to have to put up with it. I want to know how come last night Jerry got 4 glasses of water, and I don't get any. No. I want to tell you guys quickly. The day I got sober, I weighed 95 pounds. I was the color of squash. I had an alcoholic hepatitis. I had a liver cirrhosis. I had ruptured esophageal varices. And if you don't know what that stuff is, you don't want to, is because you die from that kind of stuff. And I was standing on Skid Row in Lincoln, Nebraska, sucking on a bottle of Mad Dog. And if you guys haven't drank Mad Dog, I need to tell you it's not one of your finer wines, I can assure you. I'll guarantee you one thing, that stuff has never seen a grape, make no mistake about that. I literally could not believe what was going on in my life. I'd lost my children, I'd lost my husband twice, although I don't really care about that. Thank you. And I lost my kids, I lost my husband, I lost my house, my car, and then I lost the one thing that brought me my knees and disease. I lost my nursing license. And you guys, I love my profession. It absolutely devastated me, but not stopped me from drinking. And there's a reason for that, and it's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I had an obsession that somehow, someday, I will learn to control and enjoy my drinking. The persistent illusion is astonishing, just like our book talks about many of us pursuing the gates of insanity and death. And I'll guarantee you one thing. I was in the gates of pure insanity. I got sober and almost into my coffin. And I am so grateful for this program as I stand here this morning. I cannot begin to tell you. And you're going to soon see why and stuff. But what I want to tell you guys about, why I think this has been my best year of my sobriety. I had two things happen this year. I had two amends left to make in Alcoholics Anonymous from the wreckage of my past. And one I wanted to make, I couldn't find the person. The other one I didn't think I had to make, you know. And I read an inventory to my sponsor about 17 years ago, and I pointed these things out to him, and he told me to make amends to both of them. And I said, well, you know, I don't feel like I owe amends to one of them. He said, just do it anyway. But anyway, about 30 years ago, I found myself in Winnipeg, Canada, coming out of a blackout. I have no idea how I got to Winnipeg, Canada, driving a stolen car. The last time I remember, I was in North Dakota visiting a boyfriend of mine. I didn't know the car was stolen, or I wouldn't have taken the damn thing. But anyway, you know, my perceptions of reality have always been so distorted, I can't begin to tell you. And I always think of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police on horses chasing you. I don't know, they're in cars chasing you. And I got pulled over by this Mountie, and I was drunk going about 90 miles an hour. And he said, young lady, do you know how fast you were going? And I said, no. He said, get out of the car, I smell alcohol. And I said, I don't live in your country, and you can't tell me what to do. Don't ever say that to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, let me tell you. I found out you can exit a car more than one way that night. And that guy literally jerked me out the side door, and I took my purse with me, and I had this little chain hanging off my purse, and I hit him in the forehead with it, you guys. And the blood just flew, and I thought, boy, Karen, you have done it now and stuff. And this was not a little man. He probably weighed about 210 pounds, and I was all about 110 pounds. And it literally brought him to his knees and stuff, and obviously, I got arrested for that and taken to the Winnipeg jail and spent 12 days up there. And my family got an attorney up from Nebraska to get me out of jail. It cost me about $12,000 to get out of that. And I just blew it off like it was no big deal. If you're going to drink, these things are going to happen occasionally. So what, you know? And but during my jail time there, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous came to visit me. And I have never forgot that day, that guy, every day that I drank after that, I never forgot that man. And I thought, why is he visiting me? He doesn't even know me and stuff. And actually, he was this Mountie's brother. And he told me, he said, boy, you really hurt my brother. And he's got 56 stitches in his head. He had to have surgery. And I thought, oh, my stomach just grinded. But you think I'd admit that? Not hardly. But anyway, he said, what can we do to be of service to you? And I thought, be of service to me? Get away from my jail cell, just for starters. I obviously was not ready for Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. And so anyway, I continued to drink, continued to get in more trouble and stuff. But I read that inventory of that sponsor 17 years ago, and he told me, he said, you make amends to that Mountie. And I was more than willing to do that, because I know what happens when we make amends around here. The promises come true in my life and stuff. And, you know, when I first read our promises, and the book is just jam-packed full of promises, but the ones I'm talking about are page 83 and 84 of the big book. And, you know, self-seeking will slip away did not appeal to me when I got sober, I can tell you. But today I strive for that kind of stuff. But at any rate, I called up to Winnipeg, and I talked to the Winnipeg jail, and they said, lady, we erased the records after 5 years. We have no idea who you're talking about. And I said, oh, you have to find my Mountie. I have to find him. And they said, lady, leave us alone. We're busy, you know. And I told my sponsor, and he said, well, you tried to do it. What else can you do? He said, keep your eye open and be of service. I thought, keep my eye open and be of service? What kind of stupid direction is that? But it's exactly the direction I needed to hear. And last May, I boarded an aircraft out of LAX to go to Calgary, Canada to give a talk. And every time I go to Calgary or Canada, the hair on my neck stands straight up. I'm afraid they're going to keep me and stuff. But, I mean, that mess is cleaned up, but it just terrifies me to go to Canada. But anyway, I won't mention the airline, but they fly in the friendly skies. had a mechanical failure at LAX, and we were on the ground another hour and a half longer and stuff. And you know, when I get on airplanes in the morning, you guys, I really don't like to talk to people. I bring my dirty books with me, and I just want to read them and stuff. But I'm pleasant to people. And I say good morning to the guy sitting next to me, elderly gentleman with a cast on his leg. And he said good morning to me. And then they had the mechanical failure. And people on this airplane were just in a rage, you guys. You ought to have seen them. I just sat there and laughed. I thought, don't these people know when they're powerless, for Christ's sakes? You know, but anyway, we finally got in the air. And San Francisco held us four times. We ran out of fuel. We had to land in San Jose. And by this time, I was in a rage, let me tell you. I'd missed my Friday night talk. I'd missed my connection. And I was furious. And, you know, my sponsors taught me that when I'm acting like that, I had to do something real quick to change my behavior and be of service to somebody or something. And so I told this old man sitting next to me, I said, I noticed that you have a cast on your leg. Can I get you a cup of coffee? He said, well, that would be very, very nice and stuff. And he said, you look so familiar to me. I said, really? He said, yeah, you do. And I got his coffee and came back and sat down. He said, why are you going to Canada? And I said, well, actually, I don't mind telling people I'm an AA. And I said, actually, I'm going to go up there and give an AA talk. And he said, oh, really? He said, my brother's an AA. I said, really? And he said, yeah, he's been sober for 42 years. And I said, oh, so's my sponsor. And he said, well, who's your sponsor? And I told him, and he said, oh, my God, I heard Clancy talk in Toronto. I was over with my brother, and he said, I'm an Al-Anon. I said, wow, what a tiny world. And I just wanted to shut up and leave me alone, if you don't know the truth. Just being honest, folks. But anyway, he said, did you ever get in trouble in Canada? And I thought, yeah, this is really getting weird, you know. And I said, well, I presume that you're retired. What did you do for a living? And this man told me, he said, just tell me the story, Karen. I didn't tell him my name. I didn't say a word about my name. Anyway, I told him the whole story. And you guys, he lifted up a lock of hair. And there was a scar from 30 years ago when I hit that guy in the forehead. I had found my Malky, you guys. I had found him. I just had tears rolling down my cheeks. And I grabbed him and I said, I've been looking for you for 17 years. And he said, why? You know. And I said, I need to make amends to you. And he said, Karen, you paid my hospital bill. Forget about it. And I said, oh, no, please let me do something to you. I feel so badly I did that. And he said, okay, you can wait on me the rest of the trip. And I said, okay, that'll be fine. He said, I know what we can do. We can call my brother up. I said, let's do it. And he said, well, there's the telephone. Get out your credit card. I thought, this is going to cost me $30 a minute, but I was more than willing to do that. And we called his brother up, and his brother was so excited, I can't begin to tell you guys. And I said, you know, for some reason, I cannot access Los Angeles with his cell phone. Would you please call my sponsor and tell him what's going on in this airplane? And he said, I would love to talk to your sponsor. And I said, I'll pay you for the phone call. And he said, oh, don't be ridiculous. I'd love to talk to him. So anyway, he called my sponsor. And I said, then we'll call you back. And we did that. And you know what my sponsor told that Mountie's brother? He said, I told her 17 years ago to keep her eye open and be of service. That's what she has done. It's all panned out for her. And you guys, you know what amazes me? If I hadn't done that, I never would have found my Mountie. I never would have found him if I hadn't gotten that guy a cup of coffee. And, you know, I'll tell you, but for the grace of God around here, I'll tell you. And, you know, I looked out that airplane window, and one more time, the sky was never prettier. The clouds were absolutely gorgeous. I'm sure they were before I looked out the airplane window. But I felt the serenity, the inner peace, the peace of mind that we feel around here. And I just sat there and cried. And he told me, he said, you're making a spectacle out of yourself. He said, everybody on this whole damn plane's looking at us. And I said, I don't care. You know, and I really didn't care. But anyway, since that time, this old man and I have developed quite a relationship here. I don't mean a male-female relationship, just a nice relationship. And he has now sent me a picture of the jail cell I was in, just what I want. And all these Mounties signed the back of that he used to work with. And they said, you are the worst woman we ever had in Winnipeg jail. And we're so glad you're sober, and you just stay sober, and blah, blah, blah. Isn't that wonderful, you guys? I just love that. And I treasure that picture. I absolutely treasure that picture. But, you know, about 25 years ago, I found myself in Las Vegas, Nevada, with a bunch of drunk cowboys from the Midwest. And I just love drunk cowboys, you guys. And unfortunately, the room was in my name at the Stardust Hotel, I'm sorry to say. And you know, one of these guys had a gun, and they blew a hole in the wall, and then we burned up their carpet and stuff with cigarettes and crap. And I got a bill for $3,330 when I got back to Nebraska. And I thought, well, I'm not paying it. I dumped them enough money in their casino. I'm not paying them nothing. And that's just the way I felt about it. And anyway, all those years went by. I continued to drink. I never heard another word from the Stardust, ironically. And I wasn't about to address it either. But anyway, I read that inventory, and Clancy told me, he says, you make amends to the Stardust. And I said, for what? I didn't do it. I didn't blow the hole in the wall, and I didn't burn up their carpet. He said, the room was in your name, and one of these days you're going to get well enough in Alcoholics Anonymous to assume total responsibility for your past behavior. And I said, well, I don't care. I'm not paying it back. He said, then stay sick. You know, that's what my sponsor says to me, stay sick, you know. And I hate to hear that, but anyway, I still wasn't willing to pay it back. And so anyway, this last May, I also spoke at about 4 months ago, I spoke in Laughlin, Nevada at their Tri-State Roundup out there. And we were hanging around the casino on Sunday morning, waiting for the Sunday morning meeting to start, and we had about 20 minutes to kill, and I spied this triple diamond slot machine. And you guys, I love triple diamond slot machines and stuff. And I thought, Karen, do not start playing that because the meeting's going to start. And I thought, well, I can do it for 20 minutes. I can walk away. And so I started playing this machine, and I hit it for $200, for $600, and for $2,500 in 20 minutes flat. What is that total? $3,330. And this voice in my head said, sometimes my head tells me good information. Most of the time it doesn't, but this time it didn't. It said, go pay the Stardust back. You never have to listen to Clancy's mouth run one more time. Just go pay it back and stuff. And, you know, a year ago last April, I got a debt, $86,000 in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I made that last payment to Nebraska. And, of course, you know what we're like. We have to go brag to our sponsor. I wish I never would have done that, trust me. But I called him up, and I said, my last payment's made. And he said, wonderful. He said, now get the Stardust paid back. He said, you're not out of debt. You owe them money. And my priority was those other $86,000, and the Stardust was to be last. And I said, Clancy, I didn't do the damage. He said, I said pay the money back. So anyway, I was willing to do it finally. I wasn't really willing, but I did it anyway. And so I added $30 of my own money. I called the Stardust Hotel. It's only about 90 miles from Laughlin. And I asked for two of their executives over there. And, you know, rumor has it that the mob still runs the Stardust. I don't know if it's true or not, but I thought, my God, what if they shoot me when I go over there? But anyway, I thought, doesn't make any difference. You have to pay the money back. So they were really nice, and they said, what can we do for you? And I said, I need to do this in person. They said, well, okay. They said, get over here and talk to us. We're going to leave in a couple hours. It was Sunday afternoon, and I drove over there lickety-split, and I sat down with three of their top people at the Stardust, and I told them what I'd done. I laid down 33 $100 bills. You guys, it just made me sick to my stomach to do it. I almost threw up, you know, and $30 of my own money, and they were just flabbergasted. They were totally flat, and they said, we have never, ever seen this happen before, and I have never seen a casino turn down money, have you guys? But they told me, they said, Karen, we wrote that off years ago. We can't accept this money. And I thought, unbelievable. And I said, well, then put it in your pocket. It's not my money. I don't care what you do with it. You know, I need to do this. And they said, well, why don't we give it to your favorite charity? I said, why don't we give it to yours? We don't take credit for nothing around here. And so they said, okay, how about the downtown mission in Vegas? I said, that's perfect. That's whatever you want to do is fine. So they wrote out the check and so forth. Anyway, I got back to LA and I told my sponsor, I was going to ask him for a receipt, but I thought that was kind of tacky, you know, but I got back to LA and I told my sponsor what I'd done. And I said, do you believe that I did that? And he said, it's your sobriety, not mine. You know, I always get those kind of cute answers from my sponsor. But anyway, while I was sitting in that office, you guys, one of these guys was sitting there looking at me really, really funny, and he was just a big smile on his face and stuff, and he came up to me afterwards, and he said, you know, my wife's an Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, and I'm an Al-Anon, and he said, what a wonderful example you are of AA, and a star was born, let me tell you guys, you know. I didn't want to make those amends at all, but by God, now I was on, let me tell you. And he said, wonderful, wonderful program, it's just saved my wife's life and stuff, and so he called her up right in front of me. And he was an Al-Anon, did I say that? And he calls her up and he said, now this woman just paid all her bills back. Now you need to do that. I don't think that's what Al-Anon teaches anybody, but I wasn't going to say nothing. But anyway, you guys, I walked out of there, and I will tell you, the cement in Las Vegas, Nevada never looked better to me. That sky was blue. I felt the peace of mind one more time. So I know this thing works. You just got to do it for it to work. And every time I do that, I get closer to God. I get closer, and I really, honest to God, feel the presence of God when I make amends and stuff. But, you know, like I said, I got back to L.A., and I told my sponsor, and he said, why didn't you give it to my mission? You know, Clancy runs the downtown mission in L.A., and I said, because it was Nevada's call, that's why, you know. But anyway, so my amends are made from the wreckage of my past, you guys, and it really feels good, let me tell you. It just really feels wonderful, because I never thought I'd ever find that Mountie, let me tell you. And it was a precious gift in my life, what a precious gift. But anyway, you guys, the day, you know, like I told you, the condition I was in the day I got sober and stuff. And, you know, I come from a wonderful home there in Nebraska. And I want you to know that. My mother wanted you to know it too, I'll guarantee you that. You know, I had a beautiful mom that died 8 years ago, and I missed her so much I can't begin to tell you. And boy, you only get one, and when they're gone, let me tell you. And I'd made amends to her many, many years ago. We had a wonderful relationship the last few years of her life and stuff, but I just miss her terribly. And I come from an alcoholic home, and I don't think either here nor there. I don't do well with people that stand AA podiums and blame anybody for anything. And my father died from this disease on the streets of Chicago in 1979. And you tell me how a major in the Air Force dies on Skid Row. I don't know how that happened, and the fact that he was an alcoholic, and whether he ever found A or not, I do not know. I just know that he certainly did not stay sober as a result of it. And, you know, one more time today, this is a cunning, baffling, powerful disease that kills people. This is not a game I'm playing up here. This is serious business, and I would give any world if my father were alive today, because we would have a lot to talk about, I can tell you. I have a sister who was Miss Rah-Rah in high school and homecoming queen and cheerleader and all that kind of stuff and made straight A's and never cracked a book, and I made straight F's and never cracked a book, and that was the difference. But, you know, my sister was a beautiful little girl. She's a gorgeous woman today. She looks nothing like I do, I got to tell you. And she was a model for many, many years for Neiman Marcus in Dallas and retired, and now she's teaching school in the West Indies. And I got to tell you guys, as a direct result of this program, I absolutely adore my sister today, and I found out something about her. She's also very beautiful on the inside, too, and I never used to know that. I have a brother who's a pilot in the Navy in Spain who got from Operation Desert Storm about 4 years ago. As a matter of fact, about a year and a half ago today, he was over Iraq. He's a fighter pilot and stuff. And you were growing up, I thought my brother was such a dork, you guys. I really did. Straight as an arrow, Mike, doesn't drink, doesn't use drugs, doesn't screw around. He was an embarrassment to me, if you want to know the truth. And so not today, I'm so proud of my brother, I can't begin to tell you. You wouldn't catch me over Iraq in any fighter plane, but neither one of these people are alcoholic. And I have another sister who's married the public defender in Lincoln, Nebraska, who got me out of a whole bunch of trouble when I got sober, and I'm welcome in their home saying I never used to be. I come from basically a very boring family, if you want to know the truth. They're high successful people, and they bore me to tears, let me tell you. I have a couple of kids who are 41 and 42 years old, and I know I certainly look old enough to have kids that age, but by God, I sure do. And this is where it really starts getting interesting for me. These kids are anything but boring, I got to tell you. One's an alcoholic, one's a drug addict, but I'll tell you that those kids have given me five of the most gorgeous grandbabies you have ever seen before in your life and stuff. And, you know, I hate to be a bragging grandmother as I stand here this morning. I detest people that do this, but when it's my grandbaby, it's a whole different ball game, let me tell you. But I have a beautiful grandson, and his name is Ryan, and Ryan is 12 years old, and apparently little Ryan is quite a gymnast, you guys, and I knew he was good, but I know he was that good. And my son and his wife got a phone call from Budweiser out of St. Louis, Missouri, wanting to train this kid and sponsor him for the Olympics, you guys. And my son called me, and, you know, this is the kind of alcoholic I am. I jumped from phone call to Olympic Stadium, gold medal around his neck, and what will I wear, you know? And it happens that quick, but I found myself telling my son, well, Jeff, you know, how wonderful. And he said, Mom, he's so little, we can't send him. And I wanted to shriek at him and say, let him go, you idiot. It's the opportunity of a lifetime. But I didn't say that either. I just said, he's your child. You have to do what you think is right and stuff. And he said, well, Mom, I'm calling you to ask you. I'm asking your advice. And my kids rarely ask me for any advice. And I said, well, since you did, then I will tell you what I think, you know. And I said, we have a dear friend in Nebraska who's a child psychologist. And I said, why don't you have Chris come over and talk to Ryan and see what he thinks? And my son did exactly that. And guess what that child psychologist told my son and his wife? This is an opportunity of a lifetime. Let that young man go. He's a very stable young man and stuff. So I'm happy to report to this morning that my little grandbaby is at Nadia Comaneci and Bart Connors Clinic down in Norman, Oklahoma, training for the Olympics, you guys. And I don't know if he's going to go to Greece or not. It makes no difference whether he goes to Greece or not. I am so proud of that kid. I can't begin to tell you. And, you know, he called me on my 18th AA birthday last May, and it was his first day down there. And he said, Grandmother, it's Ryan. He said, I'm so sorry to call you so late. And I said, honey, it is never too late to call your grandmother, let me tell you. And he said, I wanted to wish you a happy 18th birthday. And you guys, I got to tell you something. You know, our book says that great events will come to pass for us and countless others. That is a great event in my life. And I'll tell you why. Not because he's trained for the Olympics, because he's talking to me. You know, nobody in my family wanted a damn thing to do with me when I got sober, and things totally turned around for me, and it's because of this program and the Addisons and so forth, but I just stood there and I cried, and he says, Grandma, we are so proud of you, and that kid has never seen me drink, you guys. He has no idea what he's talking about, but he knows how important this is to me and so forth, so I am so grateful for this program as I stand here this morning and stuff, but anyway, we'll see what happens with him, won't we, you know. So you remember one thing, if you hear Ryan Garrison at Greece, that his grandma's in that stadium, let me tell you. I've got some things with my family are very, very good today. It's only a direct result of this program, I can assure you, and it took a long time for it to happen. And in my case, this was a good thing, I can tell you guys. You know, when I was growing up in Lincoln, I was just a disruptive jerk is what I was, always in trouble, always kicked out of classrooms. I hated discipline. I was very, very rebellious. I really hated people telling me what to do. And I like it even less today, if you know the truth. And, you know, I never felt like I belonged anywhere. And I heard that a lot from AA podiums, and I'm right on with that 125%, I got to tell you. You know, I really don't remember my first drink, you guys, but I can tell you that I hope to God I never forget my last one. And I hope it was my last one. But I remember what alcohol did for me from the very beginning. It made me feel like I belonged. I could be anything I wanted to be. I could do anything I wanted to do. I drank at any given opportunity after that, and I was probably about 13 years old. You know, I realize that I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous this morning, and I honor your podium by talking about alcoholism up here. I used a lot of drugs to make that a small part of my story. My sponsor encourages me to do that. And, you know, when I was growing up in Nebraska, there just wasn't a lot of drugs on the street. But I'll guarantee you, I found every single one of those drugs and so forth. But, you know, when I got my current sponsor, I had to change my sobriety date. You know, where I'm from in Lincoln, you can have two sobriety dates, one from alcohol and one from drugs. And he pointed out to me that I was in Southern California. We have one date to get my date changed. And I was such a smart aleck when I got my current sponsor. And I said, where does the book mention pot? He said, well, the book does mention pot. And I said, Clancy, I have read that book. It does not talk about marijuana in that book. And he said, if I find the word pot in that book, will you change your sobriety and never argue with me again? And I knew I was making a bad deal, you guys, but I did anyway. And I'll be damned if he didn't flip open the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And on the first page of Bill Wilson's story, it says, died by musket or by pot. I said, that is not what that means. He said, quite frankly, my dear, I don't care what it means. You said the book did mention pot. It does mention pot. Change your sobriety date. And my life was flourished, I got to tell you guys. But anyway, you know, I'm one of these alcoholic females, and I hate to say this from an AA podium, but it's precisely the way that it was for me, and we're supposed to tell the truth up here, that if you pat me on the head, my pants fall off is what happens to me. And I got myself into a lot of trouble when I was growing up. I absolutely love men. I love everything about them. You name about and I love the bound. They've been the downfall of my entire existence. And they remain the same today, I'm sorry to say. And I particularly like sick men, and there's a room full of them here this morning. I can just see it. That's one thing I love about where I live, girls. They've got more sick men in that state than you can possibly stand in one setting. But I have to tell you guys a funny story. I was in Nashville, Tennessee about maybe 10 years ago giving a talk, and one of the fine ladies of Nashville, Tennessee, AA, walked up to me afterwards, I want you to know. And this woman says to me, she said, you're disgusting. And she wasn't kidding you guys. She meant every word of it. And I said, lady, from where I come from, being disgusting is a step up, I can assure you. And furthermore, if I wanted you to sponsor me, I'd flown to Nashville and asked you. You know, I hear some women get this podium, and I wonder if they ever drank, you guys. I really do. Do all their drinking and wondering if they shoot through the keyhole with an eyedropper. I was out there big time. I got myself into a lot of trouble. I've been taught to share that freely in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I offend anybody in this room today, I would never offend anybody in the program that saved my life, let me tell you. And besides that, my book tells me, and this is my favorite part of our book, it says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past will be the greatest possession that you have. And it goes on to say, because you can literally avert death and misery for others. And I found that to be very, very true of my sobriety. So if I offend anybody here this morning, I don't want to hear about it afterwards either. But I got pregnant when I was 16 years old, and I had to get married. And as it must be, I married an alcoholic. In my day, girls, you had to get married, you know. But before we knew, we had two babies to take care of. And I was only 16. He was 17. I couldn't cook. I couldn't clean. I couldn't take care of a baby, nor did I want to take care of a baby. And there we were with two babies before we knew it. And, you know, I quickly found out what caused all that, and I put a halt to it, I'll guarantee you that. And that caused me a lot of trouble throughout the years. And, you know, neither one of us had any education. It was like the blind leading the blind, let me tell you. And I found a job as a nurse's aide at a hospital there in Lincoln. And the magic was put in my life. I literally fell in love with nursing. And I made a plan to myself. I would love to go to school, and I'd love to become a registered nurse. That's what I would love to do. You know, they say that alcoholics don't have willpower. And I'm here to tell you from this podium this morning that that is a bunch of crap. I have more willpower than 20 elephants. When I want to do well, I'm going to do well. I have no willpower as far as my disease goes. When I want to do something, I'm going to do it. And I went back, I finished junior high, I finished high school, I went to college full time for 3 years, and I worked full time for 3 years. And I'm talking about 18, 20 hours a day, you guys, and that is hard stuff to do. I did not drink, not use any drugs during this period of time. At the age of 27 years old, I became a registered nurse. And if you think I'm proud to stand here this morning and tell you that I got jerked in front of the State Board of Nursing in Nebraska, and they told me, you are a disgrace to your profession, you're a disgrace to nursing, you're a disgrace to medicine, you're no longer working because we just jerked your nursing license. If you think I'm proud of that, you are sadly wrong. You guys, I love my profession, and I really, really mean that. And I would never do anything to jeopardize the people that I take care of, nor the people that I work with in ordinary circumstances. And what I had to tell you today is a story about how I threw it right down the toilet so I could drink. And that is total insanity. It's also called alcoholism. At the age of 27 years old, I divorced this man. And girls, I got to tell you that a whole new world opened up to me, and it's called men and alcohol. And I went absolutely hog wild is what I did. I was engaged 8 times during that divorce. I never had married these people. 2 of them died from alcoholism. I don't know anything about social drinking. I drank, I'm with alcoholics, and we do indeed die from this. And at the age of 27 years old, I went to work in surgery at a hospital there in Lincoln, and I had that job for 19 years. I love working in the operating room. I love taking care of those patients. It's a colorful, exciting nursing position. I drank, and with medical people mostly. They were colorful, intense people. They worked hard, and they played hard. And I need to tell you guys that the incidence of alcoholism amongst my profession is tremendously high. And that'd do a lot for your security levels. You're going to have surgery next week. But it has to be very, very true. And those people are so grateful that I'm sober that they can't see straight. And I'm talking about alcoholics is what I'm talking about. You know, in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, this is clearly that we're to tell in a general way what our drinking was like. You're going to get the general idea real quick what my drinking was like. I can tell you guys about my drinking about 5 seconds flat, to know the truth. Many, many years ago, I found myself in a little concert in upstate New York called Woodstock. That's exactly what my drinking was like. It was all about Woodstock. That Woodstock they had 4 summers ago was a piece of crap compared to the one I went to. There will never be another Woodstock, trust me on that. The kids from the 60s, yeah. The kids from the 60s threw a party that nobody will ever match, I am quite sure. And New York got wind they're going to have this big event. And they tell these people, if you don't get medical coverage, you're not going to have this concert. So they started hiring people from the Midwest because they thought we were more responsible. And we were a seedy lot, I can assure you. And I was the first alcoholic scientist deal. And by 9 girls I worked with to join me, and we met about 80 doctors from New York City, and there we were at Woodstock. I never seen so much alcohol in one place in my entire life. You could have filled a bathroom, no problem whatsoever. And the drugs was like a candy store, and everybody was sharing, we were sharing narcotics along with everybody else. And we had this great semi-truck on that back lot of Woodstock. That was our hospital park back there. And I don't recall being in that semi the entire week. But I do recall what it was like to stand from the stage at night that Richie Havens sang Freedom, and Joe Cocker and Country Joe, and Santana, those groups that I love. I come from the roaring 60s, you guys, and I love rock and roll, let me tell you. Things have not changed in my life one little tiny bit. I loved Elvis Presley, and Janis Joplin was my lady, let me tell you. Wouldn't Janis Joplin have been a fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys? I'd have hung out with Janis, let me tell you. I would have traded Janis for Clancy any day of the week if you wanted to. That is the biggest lie I've ever told. I wouldn't trade my sponsor for 20 Janis Joplins. But, you know, drinking for me at one time was a fun thing, you guys. It'd be a lie for me to stand this morning and say anything but that. But I cannot remember the fun after the pain that it caused me. And one more time, I am so grateful. And I'm going to give you guys a couple of drinking stories and get my recovery here. You know, I love the horse races, too. I love near nothing, everything I'm not supposed to be doing. I found myself in Omaha, Nebraska, with a couple of nurses that I worked with at the horse races, and they said, Karen, we're all drunk, let's go back to Lincoln. And I said, well, run along. I'd met 2 guys from Council Bluffs, Iowa, and these guys wanted to take me to a party, and by God, I was going. Like I said, you pat me on the head, and I'll follow you anywhere you want to go. And I really can't tell you much about this party, nor the guys that I was with. I woke up out of a blackout on Highway 2 by Palmyra, Nebraska, a little town of about 200 people, and I found out something very interesting tonight about Palmyra, Nebraska, that they take a dim view of naked women walking on their highways. I found that out. And there I was at 2 o'clock in the morning, walking stark naked down the highway, in my high heels carrying my purse, and it was February in Nebraska, and it's a tad bit nippy out there in February in Nebraska to be doing that. And of all the luck, the first person I ran to was a highway patrolman. And, you know, in Nebraska, the cops travel themselves. They don't have a partner. And out where I live in California, a little bit smarter than that. And this guy stops his squad car, and he rolls down his window. He turns on his siren, and he said, what are you doing? And I thought, well, that's about the stupidest thing ever they say. It's quite obvious what I was doing. He said, lady, you get in this squad car, and you sit down, and don't you touch me. Well, you know, one thing about a person like myself, every time I'm in trouble, I'll do one more thing to make it worse every single time. And I looked at this cop and I said, I'm not getting your squad car because you might try and rape me. He said, lady, I wouldn't bet any money on it. You are absolutely disgusting is what you are. And I'm going to tell you guys that made me madder. And he was going on to show you how sick I was. And he had to get a matron out from the Palmyra, Nebraska City Jail to come out there and get me. And that woman was not pleased, I will guarantee you. They're very busy at that downtown jail, not have time for this foolishness. And I went downtown, booked in that cop's raincoat. You know, cops keep raincoats in the trunk of their car for these occasions. And I went downtown, booked for indecent exposure, for assault and battery, for kicking his windshield, for hitting her, for hitting him, all the delightful antics that we pull as practicing alcoholics. And I will never forget how humiliating it was to be in that courtroom the very next morning, standing there in my raincoat, when my brother-in-law, the public defender in Lincoln, Nebraska, came walking up to me, and I didn't know he was working there that day, and he said, Karen, have you lost your marbles or what? Why would you do something like this? And you guys, I looked at my brother-in-law, and I was to say this to many, many people in my drinking career in many, many courtrooms. I said, oh, for Christ's sakes, this could happen to anybody, you know. And I honest to God believe that. I really did. The best I could do, you know. And that cost me about $5,000 to get out of that. And I just blew it off like it was no big deal. But I did learn one thing from that event I want to share with you. And this is all that I learned. Don't ever drink with men from Council Bluffs, Iowa, and I kept right on drinking. I will never forget what it felt like to wake up in the very hospital that I worked at in surgery, in their emergency room, one more time coming out of a blackout, one more time I've been the horse faces. You know, for a number of years I thought the horse faces were my problem. It certainly was not my drinking. I'm one of these alcoholic females with a big mouth when I drink, and I have a big mouth in sobriety, but I can tell you that pain as a teacher here is getting a lot better. And I smiled and got that horse's track, and he belted me right in the teeth is what he did, and a plastic surgeon was putting 18 stitches in my mouth. And I'll never forget this doctor said to me, you guys, as long as I live, I'll never forget this. He said, Karen, we love you so much. You are such a good nurse and stuff. What is wrong with you? We think you're an alcoholic and send you to a treatment center and get this drinking problem taken care of so you can get on with your life here. And you guys, I could not believe the audacity that man had that he would say that to me. And I said, just fix my lip and get out of my face. I'll drink if I want to drink. And that's exactly what I did. And the driving charges and the bad checks, all the stuff that we eventually do. My kids were in trouble. I never could marry these guys. I was in alcoholism. And I thought to myself, I need to get married to my ex-husband again. That's what I need to do. The kids need their father. Besides, I need to get even with him for all the things that he's done to me. And those are not very good reasons to get married again, I got to tell you. And I'm certainly not proud of it as I stand here this morning. If anybody in this room is thinking about getting married to the same person twice, don't do it. You're going to be sorry. The only way I can describe it, it's like taking a bite out of the same turd twice. If you are. I'm sorry, but that's the way I feel. I know. See why they love me in Nashville, folks? But anyway, I danced that man through three of the most miserable years of his life on the face of this earth. And I love to tell you guys this story about me to tell you. And my sponsor always tells me that is not funny, and you should not be telling that from AA podiums. And I said, okay, fine, then I won't tell anyone. He said, no, go ahead and tell those people see how sick you really were, and apparently how sick you really still are. And I'm still sick, and I still think it's funny, and I'm telling the story. When I married him again, I told him, I said, if you ever hit me again, buddy, I'll kill you next time you hit me. And he said, I'll never hit you again ever. And I said, you better see that you don't. And he lied is what he did. And he came home drunk one night. And I happened to be sober this night for some reason, and I'll never know why, because I usually wasn't. And girls, you know what guys do when they come home drunk. They want to take you to bed and stuff. And I was not buying it. If there's anything I can't stand is some drunk man mauling me when I'm sober. And I will say that when the shoe's on their foot, though, it's fine with me. And that guy came home and indicated that to me. And I said, you get your hands off me and leave me alone. I wanted nothing to do with him, period. And he broke my arm is what he did. And I'm here to tell you guys that I was pissed. As a matter of fact, I'm still pissed about it, if you want to know the truth. And I told him, I said, you go to sleep on that couch and so help me God, when you wake up, you're going to wish you'd never been born. And he sat up for hours, you guys, his eyes pried open. And as it must be, he finally passed out. And I started drinking martinis. And this is a classic example of what alcohol did for me. Alcohol told me what to do. I didn't tell it what to do. And I had about 8-10 martinis, and I was feeling no pain, I can assure you. And I was sitting there watching this guy. And I hate to tell you what this man was doing, but I can't tell you the story unless I tell you what he was doing. He was laying on the couch playing with himself. And I thought, you disgusting man, you make me sick to my stomach. And the more I drank, the madder I got. And you guys, you know, I'm a nurse, and I'm very familiar with male anatomy. And I'd be very familiar with male anatomy if I wasn't a nurse. But I thought to myself, what can I do to get even with this guy for all the things that he's done to me? And I came up with this brilliant idea in my drunken stupor. That's one thing we should never do, folks, is drink and think at the same time. And, this was many, many years ago, you guys, when super gloopers came out. And super glue is powerful stuff. You know, Mrs. Bobbitt has nothing on me, I can assure you. I was a forerunner before she ever got started. And I got that super glue out, and I read the directions on that super glue. And like I said, I was drunk, and I wasn't seeing very clearly. And what I thought those directions said were, if this hits human skin, you better get it off within 15 hours. Now, why would it say something stupid like that? What it said was, in fact, if this hits human skin, you better get it off within 5 minutes, is what it said. And I went over this guy. I get so excited when I tell this story, I could just do it all over again. But I went over this guy, and I poured super glue all over this guy's groin, and I mean everywhere. There was not one place this man not have super glue, and I laughed about it, and I went to bed. And I woke up in the morning to screams of horror, like you cannot even believe it. You know, I did not mean to hurt this guy as bad as I did, and I swear to God that's true. But I'll tell you what happened to my ex-husband. This guy never had the advantage of being circumcised when he was born, and now he clearly was, I can assure you. And we had a telephone by our bedroom in Lincoln. He called the police, and the cops were out in front of our home with their sirens going. There was an ambulance out there. The neighbors were gawking out of their windows. And you know, one thing you guys got to keep in mind here, they did not see things like this happen in Lincoln, Nebraska. In California, it wouldn't surprise me one bit, but certainly not there. And the cops were laughing, which led me, the whole thing was funny. And they said, lady, are you crazy or what? Why would you do something like this? And you guys, I stood with those cops and I said, what makes you think that I did it anyway? I was on a scanner with glue on my hands, for Christ's sake. They said, you're under arrest for assault and battery. And I said, you cannot arrest wives in Nebraska for assault and battery against their husbands. I knew better than that. And 2 days later when I got out of jail, I guess I didn't know better than that. And they took that man to the very hospital that I worked at in surgery, and he had to have surgery. And one more time, the host staff saw what Karen did, and they took me to jail, I might add, and it turned out to be a terrible, terrible thing. Those doctors there in Lincoln couldn't get that glue off, and they had to get two surgeons down from Creighton University Medical School in Omaha, Nebraska to get that glue off. And you know, there's a paper written about that at Creighton. Anybody in this room's thinking about going to medical school, you can read about it if you want to. I'd always wanted a paper written about me, but not like this, I gotta tell you. And I was sitting in that jail thinking to myself, I am getting out of this marriage, and this guy comes home from the hospital, he's going to glue something to mine shut. And he would have, too. I'm sorry, but he would have. And for those of you who don't know this, that happened to a lady in Kentucky about 4 years ago. It was on the national news, and I was on the Santa Monica Freeway driving home from work. I bet I had a wreck when I heard it. But my God, better her than me, I got to tell you. But anyway, I divorced that man one more time. And I will tell you guys on the brightest side of things here today, like I said earlier, Alcoholics Anonymous really does work. We have the men's step in this program, and my sponsor made me get on an airplane and fly to Sacramento, California and make amends to my ex-husband, where he currently lives and stuff. And I tried to tell my sponsor, I'm not sorry that I did that. Therefore, I have to make the amends. He said, I don't care whether you're sorry or not. Get on that airplane, get there, do what I'm asking you to do, and maybe one of these days you will be sorry. And I'm telling anybody in this room tonight, when that guy sees me, he kind of backs up, let me tell you. But we're able to sit down and talk and stuff, and I made my amends to him. And I will tell you guys, I walked away from that man. I was free what I had done to him. I was free of being married to him twice. And I will tell you, one more time, those promises in the big book started coming true in my life. So I know this thing works, you just got to do it for it to work. At this time in my life, I got involved with the most bizarre man I've ever met before in my life. This guy told me he was in the mafia. Now, I don't think anybody in Nebraska is in the mafia, for Christ's sakes. And I was lying to him, and he was lying to me. It was a typical alcoholic nightmare is what it was. I was drinking on a daily basis. I was taking Valium for severe tremors I was starting to have. It was beginning to be no more fun, I got to tell you guys. You know, I'm a nurse, and I've studied alcoholism, and I knew all about it before I became one. And it shows me one more time here this morning that what our book says is so true. Self-knowledge avails us nothing to this disease. It's action that counts. Nowhere in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous do we have a chapter called Into Thinking. We do have one that's called Into Action. And that's the only reason I'm standing here 18 years sober. And the day came to me that the hospital told me, we have had it out of you, Karen. We cannot read about our nursing staff in the paper anymore. Glue and husbands, drunk driving charges, bad checks, all the stuff that you're doing. Everything you're doing, Lincoln's in the paper, I'm sorry to say. And they knew my game, let me tell you. And they said, you're either going to a treatment center or you no longer have this job. Well, you guys, you know what? You don't tell people like me that stuff. And I said, you and what army's going to make me go to a treatment center? And I walked out of a job that I love more than the whole world, and I cannot say that enough today. And I drank, and I drank, and I died 1,000 times over. I went to work at a nursing home there in Lincoln, where I'm about ready to share with you guys is something I'm not proud to discuss from any AA podium. It took me years into my sobriety before I would ever mention this. I found myself still in drugs in that nursing home. I was still in morphine and Demerol and cocaine and Valium, and I'd get my hands on. And if you think I'm proud of that, you are sadly wrong. And I need to tell you something quickly here. I was not still in drugs because I liked drugs. I could not drink at work, and I had to do something. I couldn't go more than 3 hours without drinking or using drugs, you guys. It was that bad for me. The fun was over. It was something I had to do. And when that happens, it's a whole different ball game, let me tell you. And the day came to me when the people that ran that place came up to me and they said, Karen, what is wrong with you? You are just weird is what you are. Now, you take good care of the patients, you're a good nurse and stuff, but you're just strange. And I remember thinking to myself, you'd be strange too if you had 200 milligrams of Demerol on board. You'd be strange too. And I threw my keys at them and I walked out the door before they fired me. And I went to work at Bryan Memorial Hospital there in Lincoln. And you guys, it's a fine, fine facility. And I was drunk on that interview. I got that nursing position. And I'm not talking about falling down drunk. I just maintained a certain level of alcohol in my bloodstream that I would not shake and have those violent tremors. And I was in hot water up to my yin-yang, let me tell you. And the day came here and I got caught red-handed, stole some morphine from that hospital. And this has got to be, without a doubt, the most humiliating day of my entire life. When they said, you give us your narcotic keys, you get out of this hospital, don't you go walk back in here again. We're reporting this to the State Board of Nursing Nebraska. That's exactly what they did. That's exactly what they should have done. My other two jobs should have done it too, as a matter of fact. And to make a long story short here this morning, I lost my nursing license. And to make a long story shorter and shorter here today, I wound up on the streets of Nebraska is what happened to me. And you guys, I spent 2 years on the streets. And I've traveled to the Midwest, I've prostituted myself, and I'll guarantee you one thing, that I have seen and done things that no woman should ever see or do. And I'm still so sick in the head sometimes I think to myself, I wouldn't mind seeing some of them again, you know. And my sponsor assures me I'm still a very ill person. You're thinking that kind of stuff. And, you know, I've been in nut houses, I've been in detoxes, I've been in jails, I've been in institutions. I cannot think of a thing that happened in the streets as a practicing female alcoholic. Things happened to me I would not repeat in this podium today, but I'm sure that you had the general idea. And 2 years went by for me, and there I was back there in Lincoln, standing on Skid Row, sucking on a bottle of Mad Dog. And I certainly had better things intended for myself than to be doing that, I got to tell you. I will never forget that last day of my drinking as long as I live, and I hope to God it was the last day of my drinking. I apparently was so physically sick, I just passed down the streets is what happened to me, but before that happened, I remember thinking to myself, there was a Hilton Hotel adjacent to that Skid Row area, and I remember thinking 2 years ago, I used to stand on top of the Hilton Hotel and drink martinis with surgeons. What am I doing standing on Skid Row drinking with these people? And I rather imagine those folks felt the same way when they arrived there. And like I said, I can't tell you much about it at all. I woke up in an intensive care ward at the very hospital I was born at, the very hospital I worked at for 19 years, and I will tell you guys clearly that the alcoholic hell for me started the day I got sober. You know, I'm not a very big person. I only weighed 95 pounds the day I got sober, and I was coming off a quart or whatever a day and 200 milligrams of Valium a day. That is a lot of booze. That's a lot of pills, and I had a lot of dying to do, let me tell you. You know, they say that most alcohol withdrawal is over within 3 days, and perhaps it is for some people. It certainly was not for me. It was going to be a long, long time before I was going to start feeling better. And I laid in that intensive care ward. I had tubes coming out of my belly. They were draining a foot off my liver. I had IVs going, and I found myself in withdrawal that was so bad I cannot begin to tell you guys. And I laid in that intensive care ward, and I shook, and I shook, and I died, and I died for 30 solid days. And I'd scream at those nurses and say, you get me some Librium, you get me some Valium, you get me something. This is absolutely inhumane that anybody should have this kind of withdrawal. And they said, Karen, listen to us. You need to fill one of those tremors, and maybe you'll never do it again. I went to a fine, fine facility, you guys, and I knew exactly what they were doing with alcoholics. And they went on to tell me, there's nothing wrong with your heart. You're not getting one single drug from us, so quit asking us for one. But let me tell you what these people did for me, and I will be forever grateful as long as I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. They got about 10 people from AA to come and sit with me. And I want to point out something real quick here, and I don't mean to step on anybody's toes. This is just my opinion and my opinion only, but I need to tell you how I feel. I hear people in AA say, we don't go unless the alcoholic calls us. Ladies and gentlemen, I am standing here 18 years sober today, and I never made any phone call. You know, thank God there's people in AA that are willing to take actions whether the alcoholic calls or not. You know, if it's good enough for our co-founders, by God, it's good enough for us. I don't recall that Dr. Bob ever made any phone call. I think Bill Wilson called him. So I hope I never forget that as long as I am sober, let me tell you. My most favorite commitment I do is my Los Angeles County AA commitment. We take a panel up there once a month. About 10 people will go and talk to the alcoholics. And these people are literally dying from alcoholism. And it's so good for me, you guys, because I get to see what I was like 18 years ago. And once in a while, we get people out of there once in a while. And we got two people in my home group that we took out of there, and two ladies in my home group that I sponsor both of them and stuff. So I know that this stuff works once in a while, but it makes no difference whether it works or not. I get to stay sober as a result of doing this stuff. But anyway, I fell in love with these people, and you know, there was nobody in my life, you guys. My family wanted nothing to do with me. They've been through it too many times. I'm going to go through it one more time. My mom, who I absolutely adored, had to be hospitalized because of me and put on tranquilizers. My mom did not deserve that by a long shot. And I have not forgotten it as I stand here this morning. Although my mom is dead, I can make constant living amends to that woman. I can't do that, but, you know, give a number of A and so forth. But I just love these people. And they say things like, Karen, just keep breathing. That's all I got to do is breathe. And I'd say, when is this withdrawal going to stop? And they said, when it's time, that's when it's going to stop. And that wasn't good enough for me. I wanted a date is what I wanted. And they were absolutely accurate about that. When it's time, it's time. And at 30 days of sobriety, I walked into the official treatment room of that hospital. I'm a product of the treatment center. I have no opinion on one way or the other, but apparently I went to a fine one because all they talked about was Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a lot of bad ones out there, you guys, let me tell you, and thank God I went to a good one. And let me tell you what I was like when I was 30 days sober. I needed you so desperately on day one, but 30 days there was a whole different ballgame, let me tell you. And you know, where I went through treatment, a lot of people got kicked out of treatment for fraternizing. I didn't. Nobody wants to fraternize with an orange person, I can assure you. And they used to bring the patients over to the hospital, and they'd say, look at her, see what's going to happen to you if you keep on drinking, look at her. And I thought, how dare you bring people in my room and say stuff like that? But you guys, you know what, in retrospect today, I am really glad they did that. I get to think about that before I picked up any drinks, let me tell you. But anyway, I walked into group therapy the first time. There was 14 men in that group on there for drunk driving charges and stuff like that. And they were horrified when they saw me, let me tell you. And you know how people say the dumbest things sometimes out of fear, you guys. And this one guy looked at me and he said, you think you're better than us here, don't you? And I made a comment to this man that I was to pay for a long, long time in that treatment center. As a direct result of that comment and my risk of my bad behavior, I found myself in an inpatient 30-day program for 7 months, you guys. And that is a long time to be an inpatient 30-day program. And I completed that inpatient program, and I went to an outpatient program, I went to an evening care program, and I went to an aftercare program. And I found myself a very, very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I wasn't doing one thing the way that you teach people in AA to do it. I would tell the new people, you don't need to read the book, and you don't need a sponsor. We can do what we want to do around here. This is an individual program. And needless to say, I was not real popular with the old-timers in Lincoln, Nebraska. You guys, the old-timers in AA are so precious to me as I stand here today, but not in 1982. I could have cared less what these people thought. And you can pull your stuff around here just for so long, and these old-timers are going to start nailing you one right after the other. God love the mean old-timers and Alcoholics Anonymous. They literally saved my life, let me tell you. Boy, they are dying off right and left, I got to tell you guys, and they have taught me well. And I'll be eternally grateful, I got to tell you. But this old guy with 29 years of sobriety grabbed me out of an AA meeting one day, and he said, come outside, I want to talk to you. He said, you stay away from the new people. How dare you tell the new people in AA they don't need the book and they don't need a sponsor? He said, you're like a typhoid Mary in AA. Everybody dies around you, but you're able to stay sober somehow. He said, you stay away from the new people. And he went on to tell me, there's going to be a man from California speaking in Kearney, Nebraska this weekend. His name is Clancy. This man is a great speaker. He's a great sponsor. And you're going to ask him to sponsor you. He sponsors jerks like you. And I'd heard all about Clancy, and I wanted nothing to do with him, period, because I knew I was going to be in bad, bad trouble. And I got to tell you guys that my fears have been justified 8,000 times over. And I told this old-timer, I said, who do you think you are that you're going to tell me he's going to be my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, if you don't get in that car and go with us Saturday, I'm going to tell everybody in Lincoln how you stole money from an AA meeting. And I'll guarantee I was in that car going to Kearney, Nebraska. And I paid that money back, too, by the way. I did pay it back. I really did. And I will tell you guys from a podium in Kearney, Nebraska, that Clancy literally, and I mean literally, put the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. My life has never been the same since that talk. And there's a reason for that. For the first time in my sobriety, I was identifying another alcoholic. And as I understand Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what this thing is all about. I know of no finer speaker in the world than my sponsor. I'm not saying that you need to believe that. It's only important that I believe that. And by the end of that talk, I wanted that man for my sponsor. That, ladies and gentlemen, is how God works in my life. I wouldn't have asked that man to sponsor me in a million years. Trust me, I would have asked him. And I found myself walking across that convention floor and asking him to be my sponsor. And he looked at me and he said, I don't sponsor crazy people like you. And that's a lie anyway. He sponsors people crazier than I ever thought of being. And I thought to myself, what did he say that to me for? He doesn't even know me. And I wasn't aware of the fact this old-timer had called him 2 weeks prior to him coming to Nebraska and asked him if they brought me if he would talk. And he said, of course I will. And he knew my game, let me tell you. I was standing in my little white dress on, my little white gloves on, acting like an angel. And he saw right through my stuff, I got to tell you. And thank God he saw through it. And he said, Karen, I don't like to sponsor people on a long-distance basis, but I'm going to do this for you. Because if I don't do it for you, you're going to probably go die somewhere. He said, I'm going to tell you something, little girl, and you better listen to me real good, because I'm going to say it one time and one time only. You're going to call me every day. I tell you not to call me every day. You are going to read that book. You're going to sponsor people. You become an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're not going to argue with me. You're not going to defend your actions to me. You're going to do what I ask you to do. And if you don't want to do that, then get yourself a different sponsor. And you guys, you want to talk about we stood at the turning point. This is the day of my recovery. Really did begin in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said two words that I almost fell over when I said them. I said, yes, sir. I don't tell people, yes, sir, trust me, I do not. I just, God doing it for me, but I can't do it for myself. Respect's got to start for me somewhere. And I was just start with my sponsor, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went back to Lincoln. I became very, very active in AA in the right way. Wound up by sponsoring a lot of women in that town. I'm not bragging about that. It's not that much fun to sponsor 56 crazy women in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I grew to love those women very, very much, and I'll tell you why. They literally showed me the first 4 years of my sobriety what to do and what not to do in this program. And every one of those women is still sober today, with the exception of one, and she died in a car accident when she was 13 years sober. But she died sober, you guys, and it wasn't because of me. They were active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the first directions my sponsor gave me, I want you to get that nursing license back. I tried to tell this man, I can go through this kind of humiliation. He said, Karen, are you arguing with me? I said, no. He said, get up to the State Board of Nursing in Nebraska. Tell those people you've been sober in AA for a year and a half. You got the opportunity to get your nursing license back. And you guys, I knew it wasn't going to work, but I did it anyway. And that's without a doubt the most important thing I can say in this room today. I did what my sponsor asked me to do, whether I thought it would work or not. And I asked them for my license back. And they looked at me like I had just grown horns on the top of my head, I can assure you. And they said, how many links are you willing to go to? And I had to do a lot, you guys. I had to take crap off people for 2 years that I wouldn't hire to mow my own lawn, if you know the truth. And I'd keep my mouth shut in the process, too. And one of the happiest days of my life occurred 15 years ago, last April, when one more time I was stripped in front of the State Board of Nursing in Nebraska, and what they told me brought me to my knees for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, welcome home, you're fully reinstated as a registered nurse. And as a gift from AA, I do not deserve that, but I intend to take it, I can tell you. I went out to visit Southern California a couple times. I fell in love with Southern California AA. I know in Georgia you think you're in the mecca of Alcoholics Anonymous in the whole world, and I certainly do where I live too and stuff, but I tell my sponsor on the phone one day, I want to move to LA. I want to live on the Venice Beach. I want to, you know, with all those crazy people. I knew I'd feel like a glove, and I've been wrong about that either. I want to run the Pacific Group. I want to work at UCLA in the operating room. I want this and I want that. And every single one of those things have come true for me. And those are all gifts from AA. I don't deserve it, but I intend to take it, I got to tell you. And, you know, before I sit down here today, I've had about 12 people come and ask me to please tell this story. And you don't need to worry. I love to tell this story because then I get to relive it all over again and stuff. But, you know, my sponsor taught me early on. He said, Karen, where are you at with your relationship with God? And I said, Clancy, I don't believe in God. I can't do that stuff. He said, young lady, you don't have to believe in anything. You just got to do it anyway. He said, you get on your knees in the morning, you get on your knees at night, and you pray for God's will. Do not pray for things. Pray for God's will and the power to carry that out. And this is when I still lived in Nebraska, because I had Clancy for 4 years, a long-distance sponsor in Lincoln. And I'd do it every day, and I'd call him. I'd say, this is not working for me. I said, I don't feel any connection with God. I felt like a fool doing it, if you want to know the truth. And he said, are you staying sober one day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, well, you know that I am. He said, that's the point of the whole thing. Are you stupid or what? I wasn't playing with a full deck when I arrived here. It took me a long, long time to get these little simple things. And I asked my sponsor one day, I said, Clancy, what is God's will? He said, what are you asking me for? I'm not God. He said, but I have to believe that when I do what's in front of me, that's God's will for me. And I said, do what's in front of you? What does that mean? He said, why don't you pick up the telephone and answer it just for starters? And, you know, when I got sober, you guys, I didn't have a telephone. It took me a long time to get a telephone in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I certainly didn't want to start answering when I got it. Let me tell you, it was bill collectors, but my sponsors taught me to answer that telephone. And as a direct result of answering that telephone, I'm $89,330 out of debt, let me tell you. But you know, it's like paying for dead horses everywhere, you guys, let me tell you. I didn't want to pay 1 cent of that money back. I'm not trying to be a martyr up here, let me tell you. It was up to me. I had to file bankruptcy, and my sponsor told me, not with me as your sponsor. You pay it back or get yourself a different sponsor. And I'm not knocking bankruptcy. I know some people have to do that, and I'm not knocking that at all. But I found a way to do it, and he made me do it, too. But so I started answering that telephone. And, you know, my sponsors taught me, you run to your problems, not from them. We do what we don't want to do. We get to stay sober one day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, I started praying. I didn't believe in it, but I started praying anyway. And eventually I came to believe in a God of my own, really own understanding and so forth. But, you know, about this is what I want to tell you guys. About 7 years ago, 8 years ago, I guess it was, I got a phone call in the middle of the night. And, you know, I'm on two of the liver transplant and heart transplant teams at UCLA. And it's a busy, busy job, let me tell you guys. We do about 400 transplants a month, and it's quite a department to work in. It's just very, very wild. I just love it there. I love the drama, you know. But at any rate, I worked the night shift over there, and this one particular night I want to tell you about, I'd worked 72 hours that week. I was hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. You know, when we're like that, I was a bitch is what I was. And my sponsor told me, he said, go to a meeting, you're off tonight, and go to bed early and stuff. And the phone rang about 2 o'clock in the morning, and And I thought, I'm not answering that telephone. It's either my boss want me to come to work, it's one of the people I sponsor, and I don't want to talk to either one of them, if you want to know the truth. But you know what? You guys have taught me well. And this voice in my head said, pick up the telephone. Somebody's probably in trouble. So I'm so glad I did. You guys, the most precious thing happened to me. And I said, hello. And sure enough, it was my boss. And she said, I've got 18 people sick over here tonight. I need your help. We're going to do a liver transplant. We'll go. It's about 3 years old. I have nobody to do it. Now get over here and help me. I said, I have worked 72 hours. I can't even think straight. I'm so tired. She hung up on me is what she did. You know, my sponsor, you know, has taught me just do what's in front of me. That obviously was in front of me, but I was going to call him, but I don't want to talk to him about nothing at 2 o'clock in the morning. I know what he'd have told me. Nobody ever died from lack of sleep, Karen. And I had to say, well, there's a first time for everything, Clancy. You know, I didn't want to even get in the debate, you know. I just went to work, and I'm so glad I didn't. And I got over there, and I sent my orderly upstairs to bring our little patient down to surgery, this 2-year-old baby. And we had a jet coming from the East Coast to deliver for this child. We had some time to kill and stuff. And my orderly called me in the back, and he said, you're not going to believe all the people in this family. And I thought, well, that's nice that they have the support and stuff. I was so crappy, you guys. And he said, come out front and get your patient. And I went out front to get her, and there's like 75, 80 people with this family. And I thought, how highly unusual at 4 o'clock in the morning. How highly unusual any time, day or night, if you want to know the truth. And the next thing I noticed was the mother. She had the most beautiful blue eyes I'd ever seen before in my life, and the dad was good-looking and stuff. And I looked down at my little patient. And you guys, I must tell you that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to love at a level I never, ever, ever dreamt possible for myself. And I ever so gently fell in love with this little baby girl. And she was so sick, she couldn't lift her head off the pillow. She was so sick and dying from some strange liver thing. And her little arm, she had a bear, and she had a blanket wrapped around that bear, hanging on to him for dear life. And I've been over and I talked to her, and she had the most beautiful blue eyes I've ever seen before in my life. And I said, oh, you brought your little bear down to surgery. And she had to tell me her little bear was going to have a liver transplant. And I said, oh, you're both going to have one. And she said, no, no, just the bear, you know. But we sent the family out the waiting room. And that mom was in an absolute hysterics, I got to tell you guys. And this baby looked at me and she said, why is my mommy crying? Go tell my mommy not to cry. I can't stand when my mommy cries. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I've learned in this program, I was able to tell that child the truth. And I said, your mommy's crying because your mommy loves you so very, very much. And that seemed to settle her down a little bit and stuff. And, you know, we have an anesthesiologist at UCLA that loves to play with the kids. He is a delight to work with, let me tell you. And so when she went to sleep, the bear went to sleep. And when she got her IV started, the bear got an IV started. And his bag was called Bear Juice. She thought that was real funny and stuff. And it was really quite painless for her, if you want to know the truth. But I must tell you guys that 16-hour transplant did not go well. We almost lost that baby a couple times due to blood loss. I have never seen a team of people pull together like we pulled together that baby that night. And 16 hours later, she went up to her room with not much hope at all, I got to tell you guys. Well, we said some prayers on that one, let me tell you. And I knew she was still alive, and I became obsessed with this child, and I had to see her again. We have a rule over there. You may not get involved with these transplant patients. They want their organs come from. We cannot kill them. It's best not to see them after surgery. Let other people take care of them now. You know, I don't need to tell anybody in this room here today that I'm real good at breaking rules now, aren't I? And I thought, I'm just going to go up and see how she's doing. I'm not going to talk to anybody. I had to see her again. And that's exactly what I did. When she was 6 days post-op from that transplant, I went to that little girl's room, and I opened the door to that child's room. And you guys, I could not believe what was in front of my face. My God, the power of God, the power of God. Here was this little baby girl. It was the first time she was in surgery. She was jumping up and down in her crib. She had diapers hanging around her knees. She had a baby bottle in one hand. She had that bear in the other arm, and she put Band-Aids all over this bear. He had Band-Aids on his eyes, his ears, his nose, and I mean everywhere. And I stood in that hall, and I just cried like a baby. It is not cool to see the nursing staff bawl, let me tell you. And something, you know, that whole room full of people were in there, and something caught my eye out of the corner of my eye. And I'll be damned if our book wasn't sitting on that kid's dresser. And it all made sense to me now. And I was in that room like a flash, and I said to the mom, I said, whose book is that? And she said, well, that's my book. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So is my husband. Her sponsor was there. His sponsor was there. And those 75 AA members had driven 500 miles to be with his family. They were not from the L.A. area. And I don't remember ever being quite so proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous as I was at that particular moment and stuff. And, you know, that, they showed me what this thing is all about. It's about love and service, and that's all that it's about. And I asked the mom, I said, how long have you been sober? And she said, 5 years today. I thought, oh, my God, her baby up for the first time. What a fabulous birthday present and stuff. And I walked over to this child, and she looked at me, and she stopped dead in her tracks, and she said, go away, I'm not sick anymore. And I had my scrub clothes on, it scared the hell out of her is what it did. And I said, I didn't come here to hurt you. I came here to see how you're doing. And you guys, she gave me her little bear. And she said, you take him home and take care of him. He's so sick, he needs a nurse to take care of him. And I know why she gave me the bear, to get me the hell away from her is why she did it. But I could pretend like she wanted me to have him and stuff. And I told the mom, I said, I can't take that bear home. My God, this bear went through this baby's liver transplant. It was by her head, her whole surgery, you guys, in a plastic bag. And she said, Karen, please take it. She wants you to have it. She's got 50 bears in this room. And she did indeed have 50 bears in that room. And I felt like a fool walking down the hall with that bear. But I will tell you, that bear was my most prized possession in Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many years. Then it got to be too important to me. And you know, when it gets too important to us, we got to get rid of it, folks, let me tell you. And my little granddaughter, Brandy, said to me one day, she says, Grandma, can I have that bear? And I said, no, it's Grandma's bear. But, oh, I can't believe I said that to my grandchild. And she said, Grandma, please let me have him. I'll take you. I said, Grandma, I'll buy you 100 bears. It's my bear, Brandy. And she knows the whole story, you guys. She said, please let me have him. And she wasn't going to buy no new one, I can tell you. So it got so bad for me, I had to talk to my sponsor about it. What's a 50-year-old woman talking to her sponsor about a bear for? You know, my sponsor told me, give her the bear, you got the memory. Quit being so selfish, you know. And so that bear sits in Lincoln, Nebraska on her dresser, and Band-Aid's intact, I got to tell you guys. And anyway, I thought to myself, I need to reciprocate here. I obviously was not prepared for a birthday party, and I remember something that was in my pocket that my sponsor gave me when I was 5 years sober. I was almost 10 years sober when this happened. It was a medallion for 5 years of sobriety. And I'm a selfish woman, I'm sorry to say. I could not seem to find the woman that was special enough, in my opinion, to give my 5-year medallion to. And I knew I'd found her, let me tell you. That's what you eventually do for me and stuff. And you know, the reason it's in my pocket, not just narcotic keys next to that medallion, I'm telling anybody in this room today that I'm real good at, you know what I'm talking about. Open that cupboard, my eyes like firecrackers, so I can grab that medallion and remember where I'm coming from here. But I gave her my medallion. She says, oh, Karen, I can't take that. My God, Clancy gave that. And I said, no, I want you to have it. And I really, really meant that. And the nurses got wind of all this. We got a cake for the mother. We celebrated her 5 years of sobriety. And I must tell you guys, it was one of the most fabulous days of my entire life. And I could have missed the whole damn thing if I wouldn't have picked up that telephone. Missed the whole damn thing. How many times in my life have I missed stuff because I wouldn't answer the telephone, you know? But anyway, I called my sponsor, and within about 3 hours, he had about 50 cars in front of UCLA, and I could not begin to tell you how proud I was to take those people to my home group in Alcoholics Anonymous that night, the Pacific group. There's been no more contact with them. It's got to be that way for many, many reasons, but I know that little girl is doing very, very well and stuff. And, you know, people say to me all the time, why do you keep doing it, Karen? Why do you keep doing it? And I know of no greater thing to say to them. There are 12th edition says long form. So that this to the end, that my great blessings may never spoil me, I may forever live in thankful contemplation of him who presides over us all. And there's more reasons than that for me. You're the ones that walked me when nobody else would walk with me. You held my hand when nobody else would hold my hand. And you told me that you loved me. And I need you as desperately today as I need you in 1982. You've taught me how to live. You've taught me how to love. You've taught me how to keep my pants up and all those things. And I don't do any of those things very well. But I'll tell you the one thing that I do with 200% absolute perfection, and that is this, that I love this program with me the whole world. It's truly a story from an alcoholic hell I cannot even describe. I have truly been given, just like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, I have truly been given the keys to the kingdom. And I'm going to say one more thing, and I'm going to shut my mouth here. It has been one hell of a walk from Skid Row, Nebraska, to where I stand in Marietta, Georgia today. And I think that but for the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have missed it all. Thank you for having me, and thank you for my life.